Hello and welcome to DairyPod. I'm John Penry from Dairy Australia. In a recent byproducts feeding webinar, Dairy Australia's Development and Regional Adaptation Lead for Feed-Based Nutrition, Dr. Josie Garner, speaks with Feedworks ruminant nutrition experts, Pip Gale and Ian Sawyer, about how to prepare for feed gaps with non-forage fibre sources. They also delve into feeding considerations such as variations in nutrient value, as well as some of the risks to mitigate around feed storage, mould and contaminants.
So hello and welcome. My name is Josie Garner. I'm the development lead for feed-based nutrition at Dairy Australia. So today we're going to be covering on the topic of byproducts feeding, optimising non-forage fibre sources. So to talk to us about these topics today, we have two experts joining us. So we have Ian Sawyer is a professional ruminant nutritionist with over 35 years experience in the industry. So Ian is an adjunct fellow at the University of Melbourne. He's also an honorary fellow and a previous president of the Australian Association of Ruminant Nutrition. Ian is currently on the organising committee for the recent Advances in Animal Nutrition Conference. And Ian also sits on the Nutrition and Feed-Based Advisory Group to Dairy Australia. And we also have our other expert joining us today, Pip Gale. So Pip Gale is also a very experienced ruminant nutritionist with experience in the collaboration of animal health and production via nutritional interventions. Pip is also an executive of the Australian Association of Ruminant Nutrition. And Pip is also a very well-known facilitator of the Dairy Australia Advanced Nutrition in Action course across the southern parts of the country.
Well, g'day everyone and welcome to this Dairy Australia podcast. My name's Pip Gale. I'm a ruminant nutritionist working out of Feedworks in Lancefield, Victoria. And I have a very special guest sitting with me here today as well.
G'day everybody, my name's Ian Sawyer, also a ruminant nutritionist. You've got double the fun this afternoon or this morning. We look forward to having a good chat on the topic of interest today.
Excellent. So Ian, it's great to be together. We're going to have a chat today on the topic of the value of co-products in dairy rations. Now, obviously, it's a pretty busy space. There are a lot of different things going on, but we're going to just work our way through and have some conversation from the characteristics of these different feeds, but also our experience as well. We've got a little bit of shared experience between the two of us. So let's have a bit of a chat around some of those things as we go along. So co-products, there are so many options, you know, that's the thing. You know, there are a massive amount of options and we need to have a bit of a thing about what fits where. And we go from grazing cows, perennial ryegrass systems in the southern parts of our states here in Australia. But as you mentioned, even further north or even in some of the southern states as well, though, we do find more house cows and different production systems coming through as well. So with all those different products that are available, and some of them are very geographically refined as well. If you're sitting somewhere like Smithton on the northwest coast of Tassie, you've probably got a lot of vegetable product waste and things coming out. And
see, like the man from Smithton.
Exactly. If you're up in northern Victoria, you might have citrus and tomatoes and all sorts of things. So, but there are a lot of products available, a lot of different production systems, and every business will have different objectives as well. And so I think it'll be good for us to clarify how some of these things might work in today.
Yeah, I think that makes sense, Pip. Yeah, we can start, I think, initially by at least defining the co-products. And these are things that are typically coming out of human food production, and they're not waste. One of the great things about ruminant animals is ruminant animals take things that for humans are somewhat indigestible and turn them into positives in terms of production of things like milk and meat. In the case of Dairy Australia, both of those things are important these days. Turn them into good things. And that's what's so great about ruminants.
Yeah.
A lot of those co-products, they're the more fibrous bits of those things. It's the almond hulls. It's the external part of a grain process. Mm. It's not necessarily the starch going into bread. But these are valuable things that we like a lot.
Absolutely. Yeah, really useful. And I think it's good for us to introduce the term that a lot of people are familiar with is upcycling as well. As you've already mentioned, these products, they're not waste products. They're co-products and they still provide valuable source of nutrients for a dairy cow. And, for us today, this conversation, we're not necessarily, we really want to remind everyone that, cows have a nutrient requirement for their age, their breed, their stage of lactation, stage of gestation, all those things. And we really want to focus on what that nutrient delivery of these different ingredients is. So, but cows are able to upcycle them and turn these products into highly nutritious foods and food ingredients. So that's really important.
Yeah, if we start thinking about almond hulls have made a large impact in the ruminant sector in Southeast Australia, particularly into the dairy sector. DDG, a lot of it coming out of Nowra these days. If you're further north, some of it's coming out of the plant up in Queensland. Citrus pulp, you've already said, you know, it's a bit of a discreet place. We're not seeing that all over the place. Mm. Potatoes in certain places.
Yep.
Brewers, yeah, been there for as long as there's been beer and cow somewhere near each other. Even some of these more high-quality things like canola meal and soybean meal, lupin hulls.
Mm.
You know, we don't think of those as co-products,
yep.
But they sit along there with palm kernel and peat pollard and those sorts of things. A number of those wet ones are pretty much spoken for year-round. We're not going to focus in on all of those things. We'll probably pick three, almond hulls, DDG and palm kernel, as sort of tradable co-products that people can look for in a dryish year.
Yeah. Yep, absolutely. No, spot on. So it's exactly it. So, you know, and thinking about co-product demand and how it might rise in a dry period, and that's a part of the brief that we've been asked to discuss today. So when you think about, well, it's pretty obvious, and some pretty obvious things that we've seen a number of times. So we start to see a decline in grazing forage quality, but also the availability. So those things start to fall, and we start to see a bit of a gap opening up in the feed budget. You also start to notice that the tons of forage that actually gets harvested for conservation will fall away as well. So hay and silage, there's just less of it being made. But the thing that I always love to point out is that the cow's requirements for dry matter intake and for fibre actually remain constant. They don't change. But a lot of other things do change around.
They certainly do. And one of those things that changes is the traded forage in the marketplace. In a dry year, and Pip, I think the first one that we did together was probably the mid-1990s, and we've done several dry periods since then.
Indeed.
We would see forage markets move substantively. I mean, feed markets in a dry year tend to push up a bit, but, you know, where protein meal might move 30% and grain might move, you know, 20 to 40%, we see forage will move 100%. It'll double in price. When that occurs, you know, that in itself, not just the quantum available, pushes people to look at alternatives.
Yeah.
And it's not surprising when people go looking for the potential in the co-products, because sometimes these things become really good value.
Yeah.
And become really good
value. Well, they certainly do. Yeah, absolutely. So, obviously, you know, we're all in the dairy industry fairly wedded to our cereal grains and protein meals and legumes and the like when it comes to our grain mixes and what they provide as far as our fermentable carbohydrates and the like to drive blood glucose, etc., provide the specific amino acids that we're looking for to really help us with milk production and milk protein tests and yield, etc. But they obviously do increase as well at the same time. But over time, these fibrous co-products, they will start to draw greater attention. And as the markets start to shift, and it's just supply and demand, really, essentially at the end of the day, isn't it, when we've got a forage gap opening up. But the thing about them is that I guess our experience would tell us that it's a good idea if you can see these things coming, if there is a gap in the feed budget that you can see that's coming through because of changing forage allocations, it's a good idea to look at contracting some of these things that can be utilised to partially replace some of the forage in your rations at an earlier point rather than a later point. So will the co-market product or the co-product market move as well? What do you reckon?
I think it's already spoken. I think we look at probably the largest co-product that's in use for the dairy sector these days would be almond hulls, and the almond hull market has, it's moved substantially. It doesn't mean it's not good value still, relative to some of the other things that are out there, but
No, that's cool. So let's have a bit of a think about it then, the kind of co-products that we can actually access when we might find ourselves in this type of a situation. So, a lot of the co-products that are suitable for feeding Two ruminant animals may actually be contracted by commercial business, as you said before, and particularly the wetter style products that need a bit of further processing potentially, and things of that nature. Yeah, so whether it's brewers or whether you're seeing something like some chocolate or even things like rice bran in the Riverina, all of those things get utilised internally. So it's difficult for people who on farm to try and trade into those commodities, isn't it?
If you're not there year round, you're not going to see a lot of brewers. It's not going to suddenly start arriving at your front gate in a truck.
Mm.
These things have to be contracted off. They're wet. They've got a really limited shelf life, and they have to be shipped out from brewery, from distillery, from fruit plant. It has to go, you know, promptly. They're not a storable commodity.
Yeah. Yep, absolutely. So it sort of comes down to these three remain, Ian. The almond hulls, the dried distiller's grain, and the palm kernel meal or expeller. They tend to be three of the big three that we tend to see that are available at a farm gate level for people to be able to enter the market with.
Yeah, you don't have to be into these things, you know, every week of the year to look into them in a season like this. Palm kernel will come into Australia if other things go up in price. Then the value of a boat arriving from Asia will happen. DDG is there year round. Sometimes some of it heads overseas. In a year like this, less will head overseas. And almond hulls, you know, they are there year on year nowadays. And all of these things, happily, are dry and storable. And they go in stacks or they go in sheds. So it is feasible to look into and often procure these guys in a year like this.
Mm. Yep, absolutely. Yes, and I think that though a lot of almond farms still coming to a point of maturity, so I think the whole volumes are still going to increase fairly significantly over the next couple of years still. So when we look at the NIM, so we're really interested in the nutrient specifications. So what do they actually deliver across those three, the almond hulls, the dried distiller's grain, and the palm kernel expeller? And when you look at them, yeah, these three, the good one of the starting points is that they're mostly dry. So, you know, we're not talking about wet products. They're going to bring us undone. So they can store pretty well. But as you can see, there's a fairly significant range in the protein delivery. So, and not only in the, I mean, we've got crude protein there, but particularly if you look at the effective rumen-degradable protein and then the digestible undegradable protein, which is the digestible portion of the bypass protein for people listening in. And the ADICP, would you like to give us a little explanation? Why we have ADICP?
That stands for acid detergent insoluble crude protein. And it's the proportion of the crude protein that is going to end up going out the backside of the cow.
Mm.
It's bound up and it will be, by definition, undigestible. And so, yeah, we're all interested in crude protein. By the way, we'll be at least as interested in the carbohydrate fractions, but let's start with those protein fractions.
Yep.
You know, we've got three things there. One is almond hulls. It's quite low in crude protein. Yeah, 51 gram, just 5% of crude protein. That's not a lot of crude protein. Mm. Alternately, DDG, you know, is nearly 30% crude protein. Very different style of crude protein to something like canola meal, of course. Not as digestible in its crude protein in some regards as canola meal or as lupins. Different styles of things. And sitting in the middle there is palm kernel, coming in at a mid-range of its crude protein, you know, at 16.5%. But again, you know, not as high a quality as some of our more traditional protein sources. And that's why in a good year, we tend to run with canola meal and soya bean meal and peas and lupins and beans.
Yep.
You know, there's not as much DDG used as some of those products.
Mm. Yeah. We could drill down to the specific amino acids. We won't today because that's not the brief. But you know, clearly there's some differences in the quality of the proteins that we have here in these meals. But you know, and we could spend a lot of time talking about metabolizable protein, and that's where the fermentable carbohydrates become really important as well. So we need some fermentable carbs here to actually match up with that effective rumen-degradable protein. So when we look at those NFC, non-fiber carbohydrates, or the carbohydrates that are going to contribute energy to be able to utilize more of that effective rumen-degradable protein, we can see that there's a massive range again. Like, it really shifts, doesn't it?
So look at that. I mean, you know, like non-fiber carbohydrate, for those of you out there, it's like your sugars and your starch and your pectins. It's a simple carbohydrate. And that's the stuff that grows a lot of bugs in the rumen.
Yep.
And we grow a lot of bugs. It's good for protein delivery out of the rumen into the intestine. It's good for protein yield, protein test in a herd. Mm. And we like that stuff. And look at those almond hulls. Like 50% of what's in those almond hulls is a fermentable carbohydrate. That's handy. By the way, guys, you still can't just take your grain out, but by golly, that's an interesting complement to some of the diets that we pull together. Yep. Compare that to the next two, and particularly to the pan kernel. Now, there is not a lot of fermentable carbohydrate in pan kernel. It's protein, and there's a fair bit of lignin, and there's a fair bit of fiber in there, again, 65, 66% NDF.
Yep.
So that stuff, you know, is quite fibrous. But doesn't mean it's not useful. You know, it's a good mid-range tool in a lot of regards. Drop back to DDG. You get massive comments on the DDG, Pip.
Yeah, and so again, you know, when you come back through, so, you know, the NDF's not off the charts, and the ADF's okay. So, you know, it's reasonably digestible, the fibre that is there. So, again, the particle size is going to be quite small because we're looking at the chemical composition here. But we need to think about in very practical terms. When we think about diets, we always have to think about the physical particle size as well. So it's not going to offer a lot in terms of physically effective fibre in the rumen, but still it's a fibrous material, and the microbiome can readily utilise it and digest it and convert it into volatile fatty acids and all the really good things that we want it to do, to become blood glucose precursors and continue to either hold or drive productivity in these lactating animals.
Yeah, very much so. You look at these things, and even though they've got, in theory, pretty much enough NDF to support a diet, you still have to provide some long fibre, even with the palm kernel. The particle size of the palm kernel demands that there's still, you know, 2 to 3 kilos of something chewable in there. If you go back to the naughty drought when we were feeding, you know, like 8 or 9 kilos in the bales and, you know, 6 or 7 kilos of palm kernel in a palm cart, roughed up palm cart up the back of Barrymore and Shepparton or along the Murray somewhere, if you didn't provide 2 or 3 kilos of cereal hay, that just didn't work.
Yeah.
But when you did provide 2 or 3 kilos of cereal hay and some palm and a reasonably high quality, you know, grain or pellet in the dairy, it holds some pretty good milk out of that.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, spot on. And so we can see there's a bit of fat in these things as well. There's not a lot of fat in almond hulls. They're pretty low, but the DDG and palm kernel, both sitting around that 7.5% or 74, 75 grams per kilo on a dry matter basis. So it's a little bit higher. That's contributing to some of the ME in both of those feeds. But by the same token, you know, they're not things that we feed massively, so I don't think we need to be too concerned about rumen stasis and things of that nature. They're still pretty safe to bring through. Look, I've intentionally put megajoules of energy down the list. It's always a bit controversial. I know if Professor Bill Weiss was here, he'd tell us that we're being a bit naughty putting a megajoule value on an individual feed ingredient, but that's okay. It's what we're familiar with. So, it's always a bit challenging. But I'm really interested in the non-fiber carbohydrates in particular. I think they actually tell us a lot about these feeds as well. And their value and the end products of fermentation that then become metabolic fuel for our dairy cows. So the ME there, you know, there's obviously, a range across these things. And you will see a lot of different quotes out of industry as well as to where megajoules sit. Obviously the DDG is showing as the highest form of energy here. But, man, I do like that 511 grams of non-fiber carbs in those almond hulls as well. So, we can keep those things in balance. And then obviously calcium, phosphorus, magnesium, three major macro minerals for a lactating dairy animal. We can see where they sit. The DDG and palm tend to be higher in phosphorus than calcium, which is a little bit, can we say, arse about relative to the requirements of the cows. But most people are going to be bringing in some other minerals to balance that ration out. But that's where they sit in their standard form.
You're certainly not feeding those things for calcium or magnesium, mate.
No, you're not. That's right, exactly. So it leads us to the question, how best to utilise an E, and you've got in brackets here, not on the ground.
No. We've learned something from 4 or 5 droughts about through this, and even our esteemed colleagues in beef and sheep production are now recognising we just don't put things like this on the ground. It's incredibly wasteful. It's just not the way to go.
Yep.
But... there's many good things we can do as we introduce each of these things into a diet. Do you want to kick off with the almond
holes? Yeah, let's go with the almond holes then. So the thing I think is good about them, you know, they do offer some physically effective NDF, and particularly when they're whole. And, you know, we've played around with this ingredient quite a bit over the last 10 years. And certainly, yeah, find that the physical size of those holes when they're whole is enough to actually be able to change the concentration gradient when we have rumen motility and actually get those volatile fatty acids that are being produced in the rumen to the papillae, so that we actually get that exchange of VFA out and bicarbonate back in. So really helpful from that perspective. It's pretty digestible. There's a nice little bit of soluble fiber in there as well. But that great delivery of non-farm carbs is really the thing that stands out to me in the almond holes. Because at the end of the day, lactating animals, we love things that stimulate blood glucose and that total blood glucose position over day. So that's really strong and really important. And so when forage is limited, but we need to have, you know, it's good to use it when forage is limited. It can be a nice little replacement there. But we do need some controls because, again, with those fermentable carbs, I have seen in my experience even beef animals in a feed yard having high almond whole rations and still having some challenges around SARA. So we do need to have some control. So from my experience, it's best used, in a situation in a PMR or TMR situation to get the best out of them and be able to control it in the total ration. You can get used as an ingredient in grain mixes if people want to try and attack it that way. If you've only got an inchid feed system, you can utilize it in that way if they've been milled. But we seem to think that somewhere up to 15% of the total ration contribution as almond holes seems pretty sensible place to pitch those almond holes in.
It was a good paper at one of the big US scientific dairy meetings a year or so ago back. And there was a big survey out of California, which is kind of like the home of almond hole feeding until we got going in Australia. And yeah, that 2 to 4 kgs per day of almond holes is probably about as far as you want to go. 2 is easy. 3 is doing fine. Once you get to 4, you're probably pushing the boundaries of where you want to go with almond holes just for the diet overall.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I reckon that almond holes fit into a diet roughly where cereal hay fits into a diet over summer.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's a lower protein, mid-range energy. You know, if somebody said to me there's something that's 6 or 7% protein and it's, 40, 50 NDF or something like that, I'm like, oh, it's cereal though. Well, you know, it could be almond holes as well. So you tend to use it like that. And
yep.
For each of these co-products, we kind of liken them to a more traditional hay. So we're going to say almond holes is a bit like cereal hay, you know, in a truck.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
That's where it fits in.
Perfect. And then our DDG. So we're talking fairly specifically today about the DDG from wheat. So again, what we do like about is that it's quite a highly palatable product. So you don't get too much rejection when you feed when you wheel out some DDG. So it goes well, moderate NDF delivery, but the particle size is small, so it's not physically effective NDF. So we need to be careful of that one. It's got a nice combination of effective rumen degradable and digestible undegradable protein, but we just need to be aware again of those acid detergent insoluble crude protein variances and that part that might not necessarily be digestible. So don't see it as replacing canola meal or soybean meal as your primary protein meals and delivering the specific amino acids that we want to sustain lactation in dairy cows, but it still fits pretty well. So.
It's nice stuff, you know. 2-3 kilos of DDG is very achievable if you are scratching for protein overall in the ration. Little bit of urea usage sometimes with the DDG is good. We should touch on the urea usage being handy with the almond holes to stop up the protein.
Sure.
But some of that soluble protein sitting with the DDG is very handy. And again, if you want to liken it to something, we'll liken it to legume hay in a tipper truck.
In a truck, yeah. Yeah, perfect. And then our palm. Look, I guess I've seen a fair bit of palm in my time, having spent a lot of time on the other side of the Tasman. So shout out Kia ora to any of our expat Kiwis that might be listening in today. But again, it's a very low-risk feed ingredient. A lot of people utilise it and will feed it in open troughs, open feeders, when forage is limited, and that might be to lactating animals or dry stock. It's really high when you look at the chemical composition. The NDF's really high. You know, it has a very similar NDF to cereal hay, you know, so it's really high in NDF, but you've got to remember the particle size is quite small, so it's not particularly physically effective. So we just need to be aware of that. Neither is it highly digestible. So it's safe because it has very low delivery of fermentable carbohydrates. But I've got there, but just be aware that means that you shouldn't expect high performance. So it's safe, but don't expect a lot of performance out of your palm kernels. Ian, am I being fair? I'm not being too harsh, am I?
You've been each fair. But, you know, in the end, that is not one of life's great precursors for glucose. And without glucose, we don't get milk volume. And without glucose, we don't get milk protein yield and test. So, you know, again, you know, it's that classic mid-range co-product, mid-range protein, mid-range energy. In my world, pasture ain't a tipper truck.
Yep, there you go. Perfect. Excellent. So we need to think about if there's any associated risks with these things as well. So, Ian, what's your experience in and around any of the associated risks with these co-products?
Well, they're stored outside often, particularly in the case of almond hulls. So we have to be aware that, you know, the weather's got on some of these jobbies. And even with almond hulls, we can see a bit of variation in the moisture. Sometimes the truck arrives a bit heavier and sometimes the truck arrives a bit lighter. But when we're out in the weather, probably mould, and potentially because of the mould, mycotoxins are something that we have to be aware of. If stuff is arriving to you and you can see mould on it, for goodness sakes, do a mould count on it. That's a quick and fast way of understanding the risk that you have from toxins and potential.
Yep.
You know, real challenges around production, reproduction. Goodness knows we don't want abortions.
Yeah.
Just be aware of that stuff.
Yeah, for sure. Absolutely. And so with the mycotoxins, if you go to do testing of specific mycotoxins, that can be an expensive game and slow turnaround as well. So what are your thoughts on mold species? Is it worthwhile getting that mold species identification as well?
Look, there's a couple of labs will do that. One at Bendigo for sure will do it. Yeah, they'll do a mold count, which will give you a number and a risk number, and they'll also identify the species. And we know that if we've got fusarium, we've got a couple of different sort of toxins one way, and if we've got aspergillus, we've got an aflatoxin another way, and none of them are good, but it's handy to know what's there.
Yeah.
With almond hulls, just be aware. Now, almond hulls can come hammer milled or they can come whole. And normally the whole almond hulls are preferred, because they're a bit cheaper, but also they have that effective fibre aspect about them, which the hammer milled almond hulls just don't.
Yep. Yep. Okay. No, that's really good. DDG tends to be a pretty safe product. It's typically managed well, it's stored well, and so we tend to see a lot less variability from that perspective and much less of a mycotoxin risk. So I think for most people, they can head into that one with a fair degree of comfort. And palm kernel is a bit of an interesting one as well, isn't it? Because it does come in from a lot of tropical regions, and we're not quite sure how it's been handled or managed before it gets to our shores. So or even how it might be stored here as well, I guess, is open for comment as well. But, it can be prone to heating as a result of some of the moisture that it's picking up coming through on the way through. And there is some aflatoxin risk associated with it. So I think definitely some scheduled testing is advisable when you're using palm in lactating animals in particular. But then also just be aware of any physical contaminants as well. And so ask your supplier to screen for hardware, etc. So
I think that's very sensible, you know. Anytime there's been palm kernel heading through feed mills, we know that the magnets in the feed mills are picking up some interesting bits and pieces, and you don't want that in your herd if you're buying it directly on farm. I'm with you, Pip. I think DDG is a pretty consistent product in Australia these days with the domestic stuff. The guys that are producing it are doing a pretty fair job. The palm kernel, it's a bit like Christmas every time you open a truck of. So every time a ship arrives, you've got to be a little bit certain as to what's happening. So
yeah.
Hopefully it's pretty good when it arrives.
Yeah, absolutely. It's like still a valuable feed, absolutely. So we've got a couple of, we need to talk about in the context of a ration. So we've drawn a couple of rations here, and we've used the Ruminate program. I think a lot of people are familiar with it, and it does these nice little comparative analysis rations that you can run. And so we looked at for a grazing ration, mid lactation type scenario, if somebody's sitting around 25 litres with a 550 kg cow, and we just said, all right, well, what if there's a limit to the amount of forage that's available. So in this diet, we've got a base of 6 kilos of dry matter of ryegrass, just some summer ryegrass out in Gippsland, and 6 kilos of a ryegrass clover silage. And then they've got 6 kilos of their grain mix, their wheat, lupins, canola coming through and balanced with their minerals. And we said, all right, well, if we can run almond hulls or distiller's grains or palm kernel meal back through these cows to try and provide enough nutrient to hit that or maintain that 25 litres of production, because from the forage that's currently available, we're a little bit short, so we need some extra nutrients. So when we look at these then, if we start to, in ration one, what we've done is we've utilized around 3 kilograms of almond hulls on an as-fed basis to come in and balance out that ration and maintain around that 222 megajoules of energy and towards 2 kilos of metabolizable protein. And we find that, yeah, okay, well, we can do that. The cows can eat it. It's not a physical constraint and the like. And we can maintain that 25 litres of production with 3 kilos as fed, or 2.63 on a dry matter basis. So all the numbers on the screen there are all on a dry matter basis. So maybe I should talk to that. 2.63 kilos of dry matter of the almond hulls will get you there. And you can see at the bottom line as well, everyone's usually interested in the margins. So using the cost that we've popped in here at the moment, so that's looking at around an $11 margin. And with the current milk prices sitting up over $9 a kg milk solids. Then if we look at ration number two, we're utilising some DDG to try and make up that shortfall to maintain our 25 litres of production. And you'll notice that it actually comes in at a lower rate because there's a little bit more nutrient density there relative to the almond hulls. We're sitting at 1.9 kgs of dry matter. And you can see there that gets us around that our 222 megajoules of energy, 2100 grams of metabolizable protein. We there is slightly lower dry matter intake, so you could actually argue the toss that these animals could eat some more if you wanted to, if you had it to make available. And yep, so that'd be an upside for you there. So we've just done these on an isoenergetic basis, and the margins, it's similar but just a little bit lower because it tends to be relative to the almond hulls. It's a higher value feed, commercially speaking. And then when we look at ration number three, what we've done there is we've wheeled in the palm kernel in to address the dry matter intake and nutrient shortfalls. So again, you can see we're feeding up over 2.7 kilos of dry matter of the palm to reach our 222 megajoule objective and provide our 2100 grams of metabolizable protein per cow per day. But the thing there you do notice that probably stands out with that one is that the margin over feed cost is a little lower again because at the moment, from what I can see, palm's trading around $390 a ton as fed versus almond hulls at around $150 a ton. So it changes the game a little bit. But they're the things that that I'm sure the people listening to this podcast are going to be really interested in to actually understand how that comes back through. So
yeah, it's why we're here today. It's to try and bring some objectivity in. It probably shouldn't surprise us that the two domestically produced products that are on discussion there are the ones that are offering a little bit better value. Palm kernel doesn't typically hit Australia until it can reach a certain price. So it may not be as profitable, but if things stay dry for a year or two, doesn't mean it wouldn't become a valuable tool going forward.
Yeah, so and what we can see here is that it's all about nutrient delivery. We're trying to hit those nutrient requirements for those cows at that level of production. So we're not discriminating against any of the feeds or saying one's better than another, but this is the way they function and work and what they contribute to these rations. So we're going to have a look at another example now. So this time we're going to change lanes a little bit. And we're going to say, all right, well, what if you're in a TMR scenario and you're pushing for a high level of production? Now, this is not a massive level of production, but we just called it at something like 35 litres per cow per day in this scenario. So what we have is in this scenario, we said, right, well, ration one in this scenario here is what we would probably typically like to have between our with maize silage, vetch hay, and lucerne silage as being the dominant forages, and then obviously our cereal grains and protein meals and the like coming in over the top. So we can see there in ration one, we've provided our 276 megajoules of energy. It's 24.5 kilos of dry matter intake, 2,500 grams of metabolizable protein. And at the current pricings and costings that we've used to run these examples today, we're sitting at a margin over feed cost of around $11.46 a cow a day with that ratio. Now, if we become short on vetch hay and lucerne silage, so all I've done is I've taken the vetch hay from 4.4 kilos of dry matter down to 3, and the lucerne silage from 3 kilos down to 2, so we just arrived. We're a bit tighter this year. We didn't grow as much. This is the way it plays out in a TMR-type scenario. How are we going to make up for the difference? So ration 2, what we've done is we've wheeled in the almond hulls and said, righto, well, what happens if we wheel in almond hulls to try and make up the forage shortfall? And the first thing we see is that we get a bit of a gap opens up because they're very low in protein. We get a bit of a gap open up on because of the RDP and UDP. So we need to wheel in a bit more canola. So when we bring in 2 kilos, or in this case, we brought in 1.75 kilos of dry matter of almond hulls, we do need to up the canola meal by 0.5 kilo as well for these higher production cows. So these are the little nuances that we need to think about and consider in this TMR situation. So
very much so, Pip. A kilo is not a kilo is not a kilo. And so direct substitution, whether we're talking about a herd at 22 litres, 27 litres, 32, all the way through, just direct substitutions are not the way to go. They're not how you realise value. Mm.
Excellent. And then when we look at it, if we go down the other path of utilising ration number 3, if we look at utilising some dry distillers grain and some palm kernel in here, so I brought in 1 kilo of dry matter of each one of those in this situation, you'll find that we don't need the additional canola meal because what those two ingredients actually offer. But we need to get to our 24 kilos of dry matter, our 276 megs, our 2,500 grams of protein. And you can see when you look at the margin over feed cost, it's actually very similar to that of the almond hulls. So there's not too much of a difference. So, but that's the type of analysis that people can run, work with your nutritionists, your consultants, etc., and say, well, what nutrients are these different feeds providing, and how can they be then utilised in our rations on farm? So we're getting towards the end of the end, so we'll let's just wrap it up, I guess, and we're actually about out of time too, so good timing. So for us, in summary, co-products, they do present a great opportunity to upcycle those low-value fibrous materials within a ruminant production system. So really positive, and they can really help support production when forage quality and availability become limited during different periods of time. So that's a great way to get around them. They don't necessarily, we're not looking to replace cereal grains and protein meals, are we?
No, we are not. It's that direct substitution just won't be bringing success for people. But integrating them as forage replacements into diets is a reliable method that have seen them used successfully.
Yeah. Little shout out here, dry matter percentages do matter. And we've all seen people get caught a little bit here purchasing co-products on an as-fed basis. With a low dry matter content, just not checking the dry matter content. So a little example there, if you buy a feed at $75 a tonne on an as-fed basis, but it's only a 25% dry matter feed, when you convert that across to a dry matter basis, it suddenly becomes $300 a tonne dry matter, and what you thought was a real bargain is not quite the bargain you were expecting. So
no, that's very much the case on the, now on the brewers and the citrus, the apple pomace, those sorts of things, you know.
Yeah. Absolutely. And then we need to understand how we can use those different ingredients within the physical material within our feeding facilities on farm as well. Not a lot of point grabbing something and purchasing that you don't have the right facilities to be able to manage it. So again, back to one of your earlier comments then, don't be feeding these things on the ground. So
the wastage will kill you.
Yeah.
The wastage in that. You just got to be able to put them through a sensible means of delivery to cow.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely. And our last point today, just if aflatoxin or mycotoxins are a potential risk in some of these ingredients that you might be considering using in your dairy, you can mitigate those risks by testing the use of appropriate binders and deactivators as well. So bear cross those. And feed budgets, gosh, we can never say this too loud. Do them early, do them soon. Have your finger on the pulse of what's happening with your feed supply. And react sooner rather than later. Take a position early, I think, again, is sensible advice.
Very much. If you know that you're going to be tight on feed, don't try and ignore it. Fill that gap. Just fill the gap, but get in early. Good comments, Pip.
Yeah, good stuff.
I want to thank Ian and Pip for that really insightful and really well put together presentation. There was some really great practical strategies and really evidence-based advice in that presentation. So I'm really appreciative of the effort you put into that. We have a question about almond hulls and if it would help with ketosis in fresh cows, given it's got higher proportion of non-fermentable carbohydrates.
Sure, I might have a crack at this one, Ian, if you like.
Right.
What do you reckon?
Sure.
So, yeah, look, is it going to be helpful? Well, it certainly isn't going to be deleterious, absolutely. So, we all love starch in those fresh cows because starch ferments in the rumen directly to propionic acid, which is a direct blood glucose precursor. Now, with the carbohydrates and more of the sugars in the almond hulls, it's not going directly to blood glucose, but it can have an effect of sparing blood glucose in the ration as well, which is often a really legitimate thing for us as well. What it's really good at is helping us grow more microbial crude protein. So it's really good at actually increasing the total microbial population and the total BFA position in those fresh cows, and it's supportive of intake as well. So while it's not going directly as a blood glucose precursor, indirectly there are a number of things that are going to help us there, and at the same time it helps us with intake. A lot of the reason why we see challenges with ketosis in fresh cows is because we're constrained on intake, and there are different factors that are happening there. And I'm sure if Rodrigo was speaking to us as well, he'd make sure that we were talking about things like hepatic oxidation and what's the metabolic feedback, metabolic loops that are limiting intake. But one of the great things about things like almond hulls is that they are really easy for cows to consume, so they're supportive of intake and really helps us support that position. So. So they're not not going to be the be all and end all in that position, but there are some positive things that they will contribute.
I would have said exactly the same thing, and when I typed in those answers, it was that what I love about almond hulls managing ketosis is that they allow people to hold up dry matter intake, and if I wanted to bring on a ketosis case, I would have a low dry matter intake. That would be my very first thing that would set that off. But the sugars don't ferment to propionate, they ferment butyrate, as you say. But we do grow lean, is of itself glucogenic. So if we grow a lot of bugs are glucose too. But it's one of the reasons we say don't hook starch out of a diet. Because if you hook starch out of a diet for fresh cows and you end up with, a low starch, just the things you said, we'll end up without glucose precursors. And ketosis is all about glucose.
Yep. Yes. One of the other benefits too that might be there as well, maybe not too long a string, bow to draw, is that those fermentable carbohydrates as well, what they will do is just assist with the incorporation of soluble protein in the ration into microbial crude protein, which means that we should have less ammonia going across the rumen wall that then has to be converted via ureagenesis at the liver to urea to excrete it. And so, again, that's taking metabolic pressure off those cows during that period of time. So there's going to be some benefit in there for fresh cows as well.
Great. Thanks, guys. That was a very comprehensive answer. I've got some questions around infrastructure. I know you mentioned a few times that feeding on the ground is... You wouldn't bother. It's just very wasteful. I just would like some comment around what have you seen in your experience work really well in terms of infrastructure and, in terms of feeding out strategies, storage infrastructure, and, just some of those practical ways to actually handle it on farm.
So, look, I guess initially with some of these products, just even having adequate storage bunks on farm. This is one of the things actually that the Kiwis do quite well with perspective to things like palm kernel. Well, a lot of them have built little bunkers that they can draw a roof across as well to keep moisture out of them. So when they are on time, the shed, if you've got a big shed or something you can store them in and keep them out of the weather, well, that's fantastic. You do need to be a little bit aware of rodents at different times. There are times when you can see infestations of different vermin who can cause issues and create some other potential enteric health issues with fecal coliforms and things of that nature coming through. So you do want to be able to store it in a way that you can keep it keep the rodents away and coming through. But then, look, I guess a lot of people with these types of co-products as well. Look, if you've got a, you know, feed pad infrastructure, things of that nature, as far as feeding out is concerned, that's going to be really helpful. If you're in a grazing situation, look, well, I'm sure we've all seen people at different times just with the simple things like a bit of belting, you know, that they can push up, or some very simple troughs, and even sometimes, you know, it might be a 6-inch PVC pipe cut in half and things of that nature that they can flow product into. To help, you know, make some simple troughs to keep product off the ground. You know, those things, it doesn't always have to be expensive, but it does need to be sensible and practical. Keeping animals off that feed so that they're not, you know, defecating in it and things of that nature is certainly going to help with utilization.
Just about almond hulls specifically. So if we get into a situation where things are really tight in terms of fodder availability on farms, especially in those pasture-based systems, how much is too much almond hulls? Is this a loaded question?
No. If we go back to the Nordic drought, we probably pushed the boundaries of what we could do with palm kernel and never would have thought we would have gone that high. I've never done diets myself with more than 4 kilos of almond hulls, but I suspect if it became desperate, we might be able to, but we would need to sit around and look at what else was available. I would hope we would not get to the point where we couldn't provide 3 kilos of normal, you know, fodder or cereal haze or something along those lines. You know, 4 kilos of almond hulls, and yeah, you know, we would have to adjust diets to accommodate things. It's really hard to hit protein fractions when you get above 4 kilos of almond hulls at a 6% protein. It's really hard.
Yeah, and I think too, Josie, I'd probably say, you know, some people when they paint, they like to paint between the lines. Some artists like to paint outside the lines. I think, you know, with all these things, there are times when you can paint outside the lines, but because we're talking about the microbiome, we feed essentially the bugs in the rumen before we feed the host animal itself. Any adaptation we make just needs to be made slowly, so just adjust carefully. So if you're adjusting carefully, slowly, and being consistent, you can push outside the boundaries a little bit, but the key is just don't rush it, you know. So you need to be consistent with your feeding, and just if you're making those changes, pushing the boundaries, push them slowly, don't push them quickly.
Yeah, that's great advice. So we have come to time, but if you wanted to get in contact with Pip and Ian directly, please do that via Feedworks, the Feedworks website, or you can get in touch with us at Dairy Australia and we can pass you along to them. But thank you again for joining us today, Ian and Pip. You've been a source of great information, some really good gems in there in terms of strategies when we're thinking about how to manage a potential reduction in homebred fodder or fodder availability and how we can utilise non-forage fibre sources. So thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Josie. Cheers.
To learn more about how Dairy Australia is supporting farmers in feed-based nutrition, head to the Feeding and Farm Systems section on the Dairy Australia website at dairyaustralia.com.au. We have placed this and other useful links in the episode notes. We hope that you have enjoyed listening to Dairy Pod. If you have any questions or ideas for future episodes, you can get in contact with us by emailing dairypod@dairyaustralia.com.au. Thanks very much for listening, and bye for now.